This is Ghosts of the Internet, Halloween 2007, a live audio production of Eclipse One Media. Eclipse One, creating new media for a bold world. Ghosts of the Internet is performed by a live cast. If you'd like to read, log in and download PDF files or have your own story, visit soundsgood.info. You can download some PDF files there. We're reading live from Edgar Allan Poe and various ghost stories. Now, on to some stories. This is Arthur's Halloween, read by Linda Tansy Jackson.
Arthur's Halloween by Mark Brown. It was the night before Halloween. Arthur's family was busy making the house look spooky. It looked so spooky, in fact, that Arthur had trouble falling asleep. Things were even worse the next morning. "Help!" screamed Arthur when he opened his eyes. "It's just me," said his sister D.W. "Boy, are you jumpy. Don't forget, you have to take me trick-or-treating tonight." "Do I really have to?" asked Arthur as he ate his cereal. "You really do," said his mother. "And I want to go to every house," said D.W. Arthur groaned. "I'll be the only one who has to drag his baby sister along." Arthur didn't recognize anyone at school. There was a giant robot in his classroom taking attendance. "You sound just like my teacher, Mr. Marco," said Arthur. "I am your teacher," said the robot. The only one Arthur recognized was the brain. He was wrapped in aluminum foil. "I'm a baked potato," said the brain. Francine passed out special morning snacks. "Eat these," she said. "They're batwing brownies and vampire blood." Everyone ate them but Arthur. Then they all put on blindfolds. Buster passed around bowls he said were filled with human eyeballs, hearts, and brains. Arthur turned pale. When it was his turn, he wouldn't even touch them. "What a scaredy cat," said Francine. "Chicken," said Muffy. "They're only peeled grapes, jello, and cold spaghetti." When it came time to go trick-or-treating, Buster knew which houses to skip. "Don't go there," he said. "They only give apples." "Gross," said Francine. "And don't go to the big house on the corner," said Buster. "That's the witch's house. My brother saw someone go in there last Halloween, and he never came out." Arthur tried not to look afraid. Arthur and his sister had trouble keeping up with the others. First, D.W. got her tail caught. Then her bag broke. "You're such a pain in the neck," said Arthur. "D.W. must be short for dimwit." But D.W. didn't answer. Arthur turned around just in time to see her disappear into the witch's house. Arthur's hands turned ice cold, and his heart began to race. He walked up to the spooky old house. The front door was open just a crack. Slowly, Arthur went inside. "Look," cried Buster. "Arthur just went into the witch's house." "She'll probably put Arthur and D.W. into her oven, just like Hansel and Gretel," said Sue Ellen. "Maybe she's using them for weird scientific experiments," said the brain. "I bet she locked them in the cellar to starve," said Buster. "Maybe we should follow him," said Francine. "Maybe we should call the police," said Muffy. Everyone was too scared to move. Inside the house, it was very cold. Arthur thought he saw ghosts all around him. He walked down a long, dark hall. At the end, he saw a light under a door. He heard voices. One was his sister's. "Oh, there you are," said the witch. "We were waiting for you." "I came to get my sister. We have to go. I hear my mother calling us," said Arthur. "I don't hear anything," said D.W. "My name is Mrs. Tibble. I hope you won't leave without some cider and donuts first." "They're chocolate, your favorite," said D.W. "I've waited all night for trick-or-treaters, but you're the only ones," said Mrs. Tibble. "Years ago, our doorbell never stopped ringing." "Maybe it's broken like the window," said D.W. Mrs. Tibble nodded. "It is harder for me to keep up with this big place these days." "Maybe if we help you fix up your yard, the place won't look so spooky," said Arthur. Arthur finished his donut as Mrs. Tibble opened the door and turned on the porch light. She gave Arthur and D.W. a big hug. "See you Saturday to rake leaves," said Arthur. "You're still alive?" said Francine. "I can't believe you went in there alone," said the brain. "You're so brave," said Sue Ellen. "What's in the bag?" asked Buster. "Probably eyeballs, hearts, and brains," said Francine. "It's easy to find out," said Arthur. Just close your eyes and reach in, unless you're too scared. We've been to every house now. Can we take the shortcut home through the cemetery? Asked DW. The cemetery? On Halloween? Are you guys crazy? Asked Francine. Follow me, said Arthur as he marched ahead. The cemetery is a great place. People are just dying to get in.
That was Linda Tansey Jackson reading Arthur's Halloween. The Haunted Palace by Edgar Allan Poe. This is Michael Lachey from Woodland Hills, California. In the greenest of our valleys, by good angels tenanted, once a fair and stately palace, radiant palace, reared its head. In the monarch thought's dominion, it stood there. Never seraph spread so a pinion over fabric half so fair. Banners yellow, glorious, golden, on its roof did float and flow. This, all this, was in the olden time long ago. And every gentle air that dallied in that sweet day, along the ramparts plumed and pallid, a winged odor went away. Wanderers in that happy valley, through two luminous windows, saw spirits moving musically to a lute's well-tuned law. Bound about a throne where sitting Porphyrogene, in state his glory well befitting, the ruler of the realm was seen, and all with pearl and ruby glowing was the fair palace door, through which came flowing, 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 and sparkling evermore a troop of echoes whose sweet duty was about to sing its voices of surpassing beauty, the wit and wisdom of their king. But evil things in robes of sorrow assailed the monarch's high estate. Ah, let us mourn, for never morrow shall dawn upon him desolate. And round about his home the glory that blushed and bloomed is but a dim remembered story of the old time entombed. And travelers now within that valley, though the red-litten windows see vast forms that move fantastically to a discordant melody, while, like a ghastly rapid river, through the pale door a hideous throng rush out forever and laugh, but smile no more. Edgar Allan Poe, 1838.
This is Jessica Dixon, and this is The Disrespectful Summons by Edward Gorey. The devil gave a sudden leap and struck Miss Squill all of a heap. He swooped her up from off the ground and twirled her madly round and round. That night she saw when she undressed, his mark was burned upon her breast. Next day flew in her open door a creature named Beelphizor. It brought a recipe for fudge of pounded pencil stubs and sludge. Also a book called 92 Entirely Evil Things to Do. She got from somewhere stones with eyes and plants that gave out screams and sighs. But then the demon, much too soon, returned one Sunday afternoon. He seized her hair, and with his hoof he kicked away out through the roof. The end had come, and this was it. He dropped her in the flaming pit.
This is Nicholas Apostolina, the Little White Dog.
Hello, this is Nicholas James Apostolina. I'm recording in Burbank, California, United States, North America, the planet of Earth, in the Milky Way. I think it is one of the three major galaxies, so well enough about that. Here's the little ghost story. There was an old woman who had no family still living. Her only friend was a little white dog who went everywhere with her, with one exception. The dog loved the fireplace in the winter, and after the old woman went to bed, he would sometimes go and lie in front of the warm coals. Usually, though, the dog slept at the very edge of the bed on a throw rug. The woman wouldn't allow the dog on the bed with her, but if she became frightened or had a nightmare, she would put her hand down to the little white dog, and he would lick it reassuringly. One night, the woman was reading a newspaper just before going to sleep. She shivered and pulled her comforter up around her as she read that a mental patient had wandered off a nearby hospital. No one knew if the patient was dangerous or not. He was suspected in murders of several women who had lived alone. The woman had turned out the lights and tried to sleep, but she was frightened and tossed and turned fitfully. Finally, she reached down where the little white dog slept. Sure enough, a warm, wet tongue began to lick her hand. The woman felt settled and comfortable. She opened her eyes for a moment and looked through the open door into the living room. There, in front of the fireplace, sat her little white dog, gazing at the coals, wagging his tail. Down beside the bed, something was still licking her hand.
My name is Mark Meyer. I'm calling from Los Angeles, California. My story is Bloody Mary, and the author is unknown. She lived deep in the forest in a tiny cottage and sold herbal remedies for a living. Folks living in the town nearby called her Bloody Mary and said she was a witch. None dared cross the old crone for fear that their cows would go dry, their food stores would rot away before the winter, and their children take sick of fever or any number of terrible things that an angry witch could do to her neighbors. Then the little girls in the village began to disappear, one by one. No one could find out where they had gone. Grief-stricken families searched the woods, the local buildings, and all the houses and barns, but there was no sign of the missing girls. A few brave souls even went to Bloody Mary's home in the woods to see if the witch had taken the girls, but the witch denied any knowledge of the disappearances. Still, it was noted that her haggard appearance had changed. She looked younger, more attractive. The neighbors were suspicious, but they could find no proof that the witch had taken their young ones. Then came the night when the daughter of the millers rose from her bed and walked outside, following an enchanted sound no one else could hear. The miller's wife had a toothache and was sitting up in the kitchen treating the tooth with an herbal remedy when her daughter left the house. She screamed for her husband and followed the girl out of the door. The miller came running in his nightshirt. Together, they tried to restrain the girl, but she kept breaking away from them and heading out to town. The desperate cries of the miller and his wife woke the neighbors. They came to assist the frantic couple. Suddenly, a sharp-eyed farmer gave a shout and pointed towards a strange light at the edge of the woods. A few townsmen followed him out into the field and saw Bloody Mary standing beside a large oak tree holding a magic wand that was pointed towards the miller's house. She was glowing with an unearthly light as she set her evil spell upon the miller's daughter. The townsmen grabbed their guns and their pitchforks and ran towards the witch. When she heard the commotion, Bloody Mary broke off her spell and fled back into the woods. The far-sighted farmer had loaded his gun with silver bullets in case the witch ever came after his daughter. Now he took aim and shot at her. The bullet hit Bloody Mary in the hip and she fell to the ground. The angry townsmen leapt upon her and carried her back into the field where they had built a huge bonfire and burned her at the stake. As she burned, Bloody Mary screamed a curse at the villagers. If anyone mentions her name aloud before a mirror, she would send her spirit to revenge herself upon them for her terrible death. When she was dead, the villagers went to the house in the woods and found the unmarked graves of the little girls the witch had murdered. She had used their blood to make her young again. From this day forward, anyone foolish enough to chant Bloody Mary's name 3 times before a darkened mirror will summon the vengeful spirit of the witch. It is said that she will tear their bodies to pieces and rip their souls from their mutilated bodies. The souls of these unfortunate ones will burn in torment as Bloody Mary once was burned, and they will be trapped forever in the mirror.
And now, this is Joseph Welch.
Two men are working in neighboring fields, far from the nearest village. After a while, one of the men comes to the boundary and waves to the other. The other man sees him and walks over. "Good morning," says the first man. "Good morning to you," says the second. There is a pause. I'm glad to see someone else out here," says the first man. "Why is that?" asks the second man. "Because," says the first man, lowering his voice, "they do say that these parts are haunted." "Do you believe that?" asks the second man. "Well, no, not really," says the first man. "Me neither," says the second man, and vanishes.
Ha 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 ha.
Alone, by Edgar Allan Poe. From childhood's hour, I have not been as others were. I have not seen as others saw. I could not bring my passions from a common spring. From the same source, I have not taken my sorrow. I could not awaken my heart to joy at the same tone. And all I loved alone. Then in my childhood, in the dawn of a most stormy life, was drawn from every depth of good and ill the mystery which binds me still. From the torrent or the fountain, from the red cliff of the mountain, from the sun that round me rolled in its autumn tint of gold, from the lightning in the sky as it passed me, flying by, from the thunder and the storm and the cloud that took the form, when the rest of heaven was blue, of a demon in my view. Roseanne Welch, Van Nuys, California.
Carrie Dearborn, Woodland Hills, California. And this is a real ghost story. Because there are real ghosts, you know. But are they mindless specters of energy or thinking beings reaching out to us from another reality? I know that powerful emotions have a vibration, a resonance that clings to objects. Don't believe me? Well, the next time you're at Disneyland, hang back as you exit the stretching room in the Haunted Mansion. Clear your mind, then lightly run your hands over the brass bats that are the part of the stanchions in the portrait gallery hallway. The brass gleams from all the anxious fingers that have gently polished their rounded heads and outstretched wings. The metal hums with excitement. Like a sponge, the brass bats hold on to the thrill of anticipation that has flowed from millions of human hands. Likewise, there are locations like Salem, Massachusetts, of witch trial fame, and Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia, site of two of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War, that resonate with anguish. They are places where you can't help but feel ill at ease. Emotional energy can loom like a spectral fog, but a ghost, that's a different thing. I know, because one touched me. That's right. It was December 31st, 1999. Perhaps it was an auspicious day, or perhaps it was the place. Michael and I were at Greenwich, England, in the gardens just below the Royal Observatory on the hill, within 100 yards of the prime meridian. It's the place where time starts, the place from which all over the world time is calculated. 300 years ago, ship captains waited on deck on their ships on the River Thames, waiting for the big red metal ball to drop and mark 1 p.m. From that official time, all the ship captains set their watches so they could calculate their location as they traveled all over the world. It was just before 4 p.m. on New Year's Eve. The park surrounding the Royal Observatory was nearly empty. Everyone was being asked to leave the park so that fireworks could be set up for the Millennium celebration. Since the park was empty, we stopped, wedged the camera in a tree, to take our official New Year's Eve photo with the observatory behind us. As an English bobby approached in our direction, we started down the hill toward the Royal Maritime Museum, where they have the uniform of Lord Nelson that he was wearing when he was shot, and the Queen's Castle, a private residence for the Queen down below near the Thames. Michael walked just ahead of me and a step to the left. The day was damp and wintry. We were both bundled up for the cool wind that was coming off the Thames. Michael stopped. What? I looked at him. Why'd you poke me? He said. I was confused. What do you mean? He was adamant. You poked me in the left shoulder. No, I didn't. Come on. You poked me like this on the arm. His index finger pressed my shoulder 3 times. You think I reached around your back and touched you without your knowing? Huh, he said. I guess not. He shrugged, and I shook my head. and we continued down the grassy slope toward the park exit. Side by side, Michael on my left. It was quiet, just the sound of gravel beneath our feet. "There it is," he said. "Something touched my left shoulder again." We stopped in our tracks. There was no one there but us. "This is weird, very weird," Michael said. "It's like someone is trying to get my attention." "Is someone here?" I said. But there was nothing. Just a squirrel watching from a tree. We hurried out of the park and warmed up over hot tea. That night we had tickets for the big Millennium Concert at Greenwich. The outdoor stage was in front of the Maritime Museum and Naval Academy. We stood on the field with thousands of other people to celebrate New Year's Eve 2000. I was standing beside Michael, listening to Annie Lennox. Our right shoulders were nearly touching. Then I felt it. Poke, poke, poke on my left shoulder. I slowly looked to my left. There was no one within 3 feet of my left shoulder. Poke. I looked down at my shoulder. Poke. Poke. I watched the fabric of my coat dimple under an invisible finger. "Michael," I whispered, "it's touching me." He turned to look. There was no visible figure to see. We raised our champagne glasses and toasted, "Happy Millennium, whoever you are." The sky erupted in fireworks, and we celebrated in this world, and I think in the next.
And thank you for listening to Ghosts of the Internet. Halloween 2007, a live audio production of Eclipse-1 Media. You can visit us at eclipse-1.com. Eclipse One, creating new media for a bold world. Ghosts of the Internet is performed by a live cast. If you'd like to read, log in, and download PDF files, or have your own story, visit soundsgood.info. You can download some PDF files there. We're reading live from Edgar Allan Poe and various ghost stories.
This is Steve Apostolina from the planet Earth. The lake. In the spring of youth it was my lot to haunt of the wide world a spot to which I could not love the less, so lovely was the loneliness of a wild lake with black rock bound and the tall pines that towered around. But when the night had thrown her pall upon the spot as upon all, and the mystic wind went by, murmuring in melody, then I would awake to the terror of the lone lake. Yet that terror was not fright, but a tremulous delight, a feeling not the jeweled mine could teach or bribe me to define, nor love, although the love were thine. Death was in that poisonous wave, and in its gulf a fitting grave for him who thence could solace bring to his lone imagining, whose solitary soul could make an Eden of that dim lake. Edgar Allan Poe, 1827.
Steve Alterman, Santa Clarita, California, El Dorado. Gaily bedight, a gallant knight, in sunshine and in shadow, had journeyed long, singing a song, in search of El Dorado. But he grew old, this knight so bold, and o'er his heart a shadow fell as he found no spot on the ground that looked like El Dorado. end. As his strength failed him at length, he met a pilgrim shadow. "Shadow," said he, "where can it be, this land of Eldorado?" "O'er the mountains of the moon, down the valley of the shadow, ride, boldly ride," the shade replied, "if you seek for Eldorado." Edgar Allan Poe.
I'm Joan Ryan from Los Angeles. Spirits of the Dead. Thy soul shall find itself alone, mid dark thoughts of the grey tombstone. Not one of all the crowd to pry into thine hour of secrecy. Be silent in that solitude which is not loneliness, for then the spirits of the dead who stood in life before thee are again in death around thee, and their will shall overshadow thee. Be still. The night, though clear, shall frown, and the stars shall not look down from their high thrones in the heaven with light like hope to mortals given. But their red orbs without beam to thy weariness shall seem as a burning and a fever which would cling to thee forever. Now are thoughts that shall not banish, now are visions ne'er to vanish. From thy spirit shall they pass no more, like dewdrops from the grass. The breeze, the breath of God is still, and the mist upon the hill, shadowy, shadowy yet unbroken, is a symbol and a token. How it hangs upon the trees, a mystery of mysteries. Edgar Allan Poe, 1837.
Annabel Lee. It was many, many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea that a maiden there lived whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee. And this maiden she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me. I was a child, and she was a child, in this kingdom by the sea. But we loved with a love that was more than love, I and my Annabel Lee, with a love that the winged seraphs of heaven coveted her and me. And this was the reason that long ago, in this kingdom by the sea, a wind blew out of a cloud chilling my beautiful Annabel Lee, so that her high-born kinsmen came and bore her away from me, to shut her up in a sepulchre in this kingdom by the sea. The angels, not half so happy in heaven, went envying her and me. Yes, that was the reason, as all men know in this kingdom by the sea, that the wind came out of the cloud one night, chilling and killing my Annabel Lee. But our love, it was stronger by far than the love of those who were older than we, of many far wiser than we, and neither the angels in heaven above nor the demons down under the sea can ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful Annabel Lee. For the moon never beams without bringing me dreams of the beautiful Annabel Lee, and the stars never rise but I feel the bright eyes of the beautiful Annabel Lee. And so all the night tide I lie down by the side of my darling, my life and my bride, in the sepulchre there by the sea, in her tomb by the sounding sea. Edgar Allan Poe. This has been Douglas E. Welch.
Kirk Bailey, Los Angeles. Ghost Handprints by S. E. Schlosser. My wife Jill and I were driving home from a friend's party late one night early in the, well, about May, and it was a beautiful night with a full moon. We were laughing and discussing a party when the engine started to cough and the emergency light went on. We had just reached the railroad crossing where Villemain Road becomes Shane Road. Now, according to local legend, this was the place where a school bus full of children had stalled on the tracks. Everyone on board the bus had been killed by an oncoming freight train. The ghosts of the children were reported to haunt this intersection and were still said to protect people from danger. Now, wanting not to repeat that train crash, I hit the gas pedal trying to get our car safely across the tracks before it broke down completely. But that dad blame car wouldn't cooperate. It stalled. It stalled dead center on them railroad tracks. As if that weren't enough, the railroad signals started flashing, and a bright light appeared a little ways down those tracks, bearing down fast on us. In our car, I turned that key. I hit that gas pedal trying to get that car started. Hurry up, Jim! The train's coming! My wife urged as if I didn't hear the whistle blowing a warning. I broke out into a sweat and I tried the engine again. Nothing. Heck, blame it, nothing. We have to get out! I shouted to my wife, reaching for the door handle. I can't! Jill shouted desperately. She was struggling to get her seatbelt, and we've been having trouble with that seatbelt recently. She'd been stuck more than once, and I had to help her get it undone. I threw myself across the stick shift. I fought with it. That dang seatbelt, my hands were shaking. Sweat poured down my body as I felt the rumble of that train approaching. It had seen us, and it had whistled sharply. I risked a quick glance over my shoulder. The engineer was trying to slow down, but he was too close to stop before he hit us. I redoubled my efforts. Suddenly, our car was given a sharp shove from something. Jill and I both gasped, and I fell into her lap as the car started to roll forward. Suddenly at first, and then gaining speed. The back end cleared the tracks just a second before that train roared past. As the car rolled to a stop on the far side of the tracks, the engineer stuck his head out of the window of that engine and he waved a fist at us, doubtless shouting something nasty to us for scaring him. Oh, that was close, Jill whispered as I struggled still to get upright. How'd you get the car moving, honey? I didn't, I said. Something must have helped us. I jumped out of the door on the driver's side of the car, and I ran back to the tracks to thank our rescuer. In the bright moonlight, I searched the area looking for the person who had pushed our car out of the path of the train. There was no one there. I called out several times, but no one answered. After a few minutes of struggle with her seatbelt, Jill finally freed herself and joined me. Where is he? Jill asked. There's no one here, I said, puzzled. Well, maybe he's just shy about being thanked, Jill said, and she raised her voice. Thank you, whoever you are! The wind picked up a little, swirling around us, patting our hair and our shoulders like a soft touch of a child's hand. I shivered, and I hugged my wife so tightly to me. We had almost died tonight, and I was grateful to be alive. Yes, thank you, I repeated loudly to our mystery rescuer. And as we turned back to our stalled vehicle, I pulled out my cell phone, ready to call for a tow truck. Beside me, Jill stopped suddenly, staring at the back of our car. Jim, look, she gasped. I stared at our vehicle. Scattered in several places across the back of our car were several glowing handprints. They were all small handprints, the kind that adorned the walls of elementary schools all over the country. I started shaking as I realized the truth. Our car had been pushed off the tracks by the ghosts of the school children killed at this location. The wind swept around us again, and I thought I heard an echo of childish voices whispering, "You're welcome. You're welcome," as it patted our shoulders and arms. And then the wind died down, and the handprints faded from the back of our car. Jill and I clung to each other for a moment in terror and delight and relief. Finally, I released her, and she got into the car while I called the local garage to come and give us a tow home.
And thank you for listening again to Ghosts of the Internet. Halloween 2007, a live audio production of Eclipse -1 Media. You can visit us at eclipse-1.com. Eclipse One, creating new media for a bold world. Ghosts of the Internet is performed by a live cast.
This is Jessica Dixon, and this is The Salt Herring by Charles Cross. He came along, holding in his hands, dirty, dirty, dirty. A big nail, pointed, pointed, pointed. And a hammer, heavy, heavy, heavy. He placed the ladder high, high, high. Against the wall, white, white, white. He went up the ladder, high, high, high. Placed the nail, pointed, pointed, pointed. Against the wall, tuck, tuck, tuck. He tied the nail to a string, long, 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 and at the end of it, a salt herring, dry, dry, dry. And letting the hammer fall heavy, 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 he got down from the ladder, high, 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 and went away, away, away. Since then, at the end of the string, long, 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 a salt herring, dry, 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 has been swinging slowly, slowly, slowly. Now, I have composed this story simple, 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 to make all serious men mad, 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 and to amuse children little, little, little.
You're listening to David Lynch. Ghosts of the Internet. Halloween 2007. A live audio production of Eclipse-1 Media. You can visit us at eclipse-1.com. Eclipse 1, creating new media for a bold world. Ghosts of the Internet is performed by a live cast. The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. This is Michael Lachey, Woodland Hills, California. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door, only this, and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember, it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my books a surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, "'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, this is it, and nothing more." Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. "Sir," I said, "or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore, but the fact is I was napping, so gently you came rapping, so faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce sure was sure that I heard you. Here I opened wide the door." Darkness there, and nothing more. Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken, the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, "Lenore." This I whispered,
and an echo murmured back the word, Lenore. Merely this, and nothing more. Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there, wondering, fearing. Back into the chamber turning, all my sour within me burning. Soon I again heard a tapping, something louder than before. Surely, said I, surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see then what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind, and nothing more. Open here I flung the shutter, when, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven, of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed here, but with mien of lord or lady perched above my chamber door, perched upon a bust of Pallas, just above my chamber door, perched and sat, and nothing more. Then the abney bird, beguiling my sad fancy into smiling by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore. Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou, I said, art sure no craven, ghastly, grim, and ancient raven, wandering from the nightly shore. Tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore. Quoth the raven, Nevermore. Much I marveled this ungainly fowl to hear such discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore, for we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door. Bird or beast upon the sculptured bust above his chamber door, with such a name as Nevermore. But the raven, sitting lonely on that placid bust, spoke only that one word, as if its soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing farther then he uttered, not a feather then he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, Other friends have flown before. On the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before. Then the bird said, Nevermore. Startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken, doubtless, said I, what it utters is only stock in store caught from some unhappy master, whom some unmerciful disaster followed fast, and followed faster till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges of his hope that melancholy burden bore of never, nevermore. But the raven, still beguiling all my sad soul into smiling, straight I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of the bird and bust and door. Then, upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking fancy unto fancy, thinking what this ominous bird of yore, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking, Nevermore. This I sat in guessing, but no syllable expressing to the fowl, whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more I sat divining, with my head at ease reclining on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er, but whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er shall press, she shall press, nevermore. Then, methought, the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer, swung by seraphim, whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by the angels he hath sent thee, respite, respite, and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Quaff, oh, quaff this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore. Quoth the raven, Nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet steal, if bird or devil, whether temp sent, or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate or yet undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me, truly I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore. Quoth the raven, Nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven, if it bends above us, by that God we both adore, it shall clasp a sainted maiden whom the angels name Lenore, clasp a rare and radiant maiden who the angels name Lenore. Quoth the raven, Nevermore. Be that our sign of parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked, upstarting, get thee back from the tempest and the night's plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul has spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken, quit the bust above my door. Take thy beat from out my heart, and take thy form from off my door. Quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadows on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore. Edgar Allan Poe.
The Gashly Crumb Tinies, or After the Outing, by Edward Gorey. A is for Amy, who fell down the stairs.
Ouch!
B is for Basil, assaulted by bears. C is for Clara, who wasted away. D is for Desmond, thrown out of a sleigh. E is for Ernest, who choked on a peach. F is for Fanny, sucked dry by a leech. G is for George, smothered under a rug. H is for Hector, done in by a thug. I is for Ida, who drowned in a lake. J is for James, who took lie by mistake. K is for Kate, who was struck with an axe. L is for Leo, who swallowed some tacks. M is for Maud, who was swept out to sea. N is for Neville, who died of ennui. O is for Olive, run through with an awl. P is for Prue, trampled flat in a brawl. Q is for Quentin, who sank in a mire. R is for Rhoda, consumed by a fire. S is for Susan, who perished from fits. T is for Titus, who flew into bits. U is for Una, who slipped down a drain. V is for Victor, squashed under a train. W is for Winnie, embedded in ice. X is for Xerxes, devoured by mice. Y is for Yorick, whose head was knocked in.
What?
Z is for Zilla, who drank too much gin. Carrie Dearborn, and a cast of many. Woodland Hills, California.
This is Ghosts of the Internet. Live Halloween 2007, a live audio production of Eclipse One Media. You can visit us at eclipse-one.com. Eclipse One, creating new media for a bold world.
This is Jessica Dixon, and this is The Iron Tonic, or Winter Afternoon in Lonely Valley by Edward Gorey. The people at the Grey Hotel are either aged or unwell. The guests who choose to stay aloof lie wrapped in rugs upon the roof. A statue with a gas lamp torch has toppled over on the porch. The way the others wish to go has been obscured by drifted snow. Of objects falling from the air, the careful stroller should be aware. It's known the skating pond conceals a family of enormous eels. A voice both ungenteel and loud has spoken from a passing cloud. The monuments above the dead are too eroded to be read. A venturesome but wounded bird is making an unwelcome third. They sifted through the ancient mound. No bones or artifacts were found. A fugitive in lurid gleam obliquely gilds the gilding stream. The infant dead beside the path escaped the orphanage's wrath. The light is fading from the day. The rest is darkness and dismay. They've gone and left it all alone, an absolutely useless stone.
This is Carrie Dearborn in Woodland Hills. These are limericks by Edward Gorey. An incautious young woman named Fen was seen with the wrong sort of men. She vanished one day, but the following May, her legs were retrieved from a fen. An innocent maiden named Herridge was cruelly tricked into marriage. When she later found out what her spouse was about, she threw herself under a carriage.
Thank you very much for joining us for Hail Halloween, Ghosts of the Internet, Halloween 2007, Alive. Alive. Audio production, as you could probably tell, of Eclipse One Media. You can visit us later at eclipse-one.com. Eclipse One, creating new media for a bold world. Ghost of the Internet has been performed by a live cast.
Carrie Dearborn.
Douglas E. Welch.
Roseanne Welch.
Joseph Welch.
Jessica Dixon.
Michael Lachey.
Steve Apostolina.
Nicholas James Apostolina.
Joan Ryan.
Mark Meyer.
Kirk Bailey.
Steve Alterman.
Linda Tansy Jackson.
Thank you very much for joining us. Good night. We will be posting this in a high-quality MP3 format for you to download at your leisure. Thanks again for joining in. If you would like to send us any feedback, please give us a call. You can join us online at butihavenoopinion.com, one long word. Or you can call us at 1-818-338-5411. Leave us a message about this broadcast, and next time, join in, would you? We'd love to have more of you live people here online. Happy Halloween. Or Samhain to some of you. You're listening to David Lynch. Good night, everybody, and thanks again.